Almost 45 million Americans have student debt. Together, they owe nearly $1.5 trillion. Natalia Abrams says this problem looms just as large as previous financial crises.
We have 45 million borrowers, but that's the borrower themselves. They have parents, they have brothers, they have sisters. When I started, it was $1 trillion. It's going to be $2 trillion before we know it. So we need to do something now, or this will turn into something like the housing crisis.
Plus, it's officially holiday shopping season, but tomorrow is also Giving Tuesday. We'll give you the rundown on what you need to know in order to donate responsibly to your favorite charities. And this month, the General Assembly is gathering for the last veto session of Governor Rauner's first and only term. We'll hear from WTTW's Amanda Vinicky on which bills could now become law. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone had a safe and happy Thanksgiving and made it back home safely. I know lots of our listeners, I'm thinking of North and Western Illinois, got lots of snow, especially for November. So if you're still traveling or if you're headed home, please be careful out there. And we'll keep you company this hour at least. Perhaps you've started all of your shopping already. A reminder that the opposite of that, Giving Tuesday, is tomorrow. We'll talk about how to donate responsibly this holiday season and check in with the IL Gives folks about what charities they're promoting this year. And lawmakers are back in Springfield for the final veto session of Governor Rauner's term. We'll tell you what changes might be ahead when it comes to domestic violence and survivors of that, e-cigarettes, and teacher pay. But first, many of us have heard the number before regarding outstanding U.S. student loan debt. It's at $1.5 trillion. It's a big number, frankly, pretty hard to wrap your head around. So what kind of effect is this debt having on the millions of people who have to pay back these loans? Well, for starters, many people who owe tens of thousands of dollars in student debt have less than $1,000 in their bank accounts. That's according to a new report from studentdebtcrisis.org called Buried in Debt. Cody Hunanian is with us. He's the nonprofit's program director. The organization advocates for state and federal policies to lessen the impact of student debt. Also joining us is Samantha Morgan, who's been struggling with this issue firsthand since her time at UCLA. Cody, Samantha, good morning. Thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla.
Thanks for having us.
We appreciate it.
Cody, before we get to some of your findings, I think people hear about the student loan debt problem, especially in aggregate. They hear that number, $1.5 trillion, and they know it affects a lot of people. Do you think there's been enough focus on individuals and the individual costs for people who are holding this debt?
You know, absolutely not. And that's actually one of the things we focus on here at Student Debt Crisis, and that's connecting individually, one-on-one, with people who struggle with student debt. And I'm so glad you mentioned at the top of the hour, we can't ignore $1.5 trillion, 45 million Americans, but it doesn't really get to the day-to-day impact. And so how we peel back the layers on this crisis is two-pronged. We have to do more data that really touches on the impact of our lives. And I say ours because I have student debt myself. And also we need to talk to borrowers more about their stories one-on-one. And I really love that part of our work, because when you talk to borrowers, you hear some of the most selfless and thought-warming stories about what people would do if they were freed from this terrible burden of student loan debt. So we did a survey with 7,000 student loan borrowers with a social impact startup named Summer. And through the 7,000 respondents, we heard from borrowers in Illinois who were impacted by student debt. And there was one story from Amanda that really caught me. And Amanda said, student debt prevented me from doing many of the things my parents took for granted, having kids, buying a house, and buying a car. And I think when we talk to borrowers, we really can understand that this isn't the same type of student loan system from 10, 20 years ago. This isn't our parents' tuition cost. The issue has changed. And by just talking to borrowers, you can really start to bend some of the stigmas that prevent truly understanding the crisis as it is today.
Well, Samantha, I wonder if we can hear your story a little bit. What kinds of loans do you have? About how much do you owe?
So I only have federal loans. I don't have any private loans and neither does my husband, which is a good thing because, you know, there's certain protections that are guaranteed, you know, when you have federal loans that aren't necessarily guaranteed with private. So we do only have the federal loans, and we together combined have about 60,000. He has a little bit more than I do, but combined we're right around 60.
And Samantha, how far away are you from college? How long have you been paying off this debt?
So I graduated about 2 years ago from UCLA. I was a non-traditional student, so a little bit older, as was my husband. So we were not living at home. You know, we were paying rent for ourselves, you know, paying for utilities and car payments and working. And so while going to school, we had to take out loans, you know, not only to pay for tuition and books and things like that, but to actually, you know, subsidize some of the cost of living, given you have to physically be at school and not be at work for large quantities of the day, and still be able to pay your rent and your bills and all those things.
And since you've graduated, have you been able to find you and your husband? I don't know how it's been for you all to find work in terms of having the income that you need to pay off this kind of debt.
Yeah, so I mean, we both have found jobs. You know, we're have moved on from the jobs that we were working while we're in school, which is a good thing. But you know, wages aren't where they should be, and that's obviously an issue in itself. And so, I've actually gone on an income-based repayment plan, so that you know, my standard repayment was a huge portion of my monthly income, and so that actually changed my repayment timeline from 10 years, which is what you're at with like a standard repayment, to 20 years. So that has, you know, pushed back the timeline of which I'm going to actually pay them off. And then also because of the lowered payments, the interest and the increased timeline, you know, you're actually not really paying your loans off. They're actually increasing and you're really just,
right.
You know,
you're probably spending about 10 years paying interest, right? Before
exactly,
you get to the principal
exactly.
of it.
So you generally end up at that 20 or 25 year mark with a huge sum balance that's generally, you know, forgiven. Whereas my husband is going to, you know, stay in the standard and actually pay his off in 10 years. And obviously as a team, you know, we're all in, you know, we're in it together in terms of whose loans are paid off and whose aren't, but it's definitely put me in a situation where, you know, I'm really not paying them off. I'm just, you know, staying really in good standing, not going into default or anything like that, and, you know, negatively impacting my credit or my financial situation. But it's a daily struggle.
And when you say that it's a daily struggle, Samantha, I wonder if you can give us a sense. You said originally that this was a really big proportion of your income you were paying to pay off the debt. Can you give us a sense of how much you have been, how much of your income, you and your husband's income, goes towards paying off your student loan debt?
Yeah. So, I mean, when my when I was given this, just the standard repayment bill, this was a couple year and a half or so ago, it was over $300 a month, maybe close to four. I mean, we do have a son. We have a three-year-old. So I work part-time because, you know, cost of childcare. If we were to put him in childcare, I'd be pretty much turning over my entire salary to that. So to balance, you know, that cost, I, you know, don't work full-time. So I went on the income-based repayment, and that did drop my payments down to about $80 a month. So that's obviously, you know, not obviously, but that is something that is affordable. But because my husband is able to work full time and he does have, you know, a higher income than I do, he is on the standard repayment. So, you know, he is paying $500 a month, which, you know, that's a huge bill for anybody.
So, yeah, so you guys are paying about $400, $500, $600 a month together for your debt, it sounds like.
Right, if you add my 80 on top of that, then like you said, yeah, close to five or six. So, that is like a huge, you know, it's bigger than any individual utility bill or credit card bill or car payment bill or anything like that. It is, you know, second to our rent, our biggest bill that we pay. And, you know, that's something that we obviously, as younger parents and renters, you know, owning a home is something that we look forward to and would like to be saving for. But with that sort of looming over our shoulders, we feel responsibly that we need to pay that off before we look into becoming homeowners, which, you know, as he's 31 and I'm almost 30, that's something that we, you know, would have liked to have already accomplished by now.
Mm-hmm. Samantha, thanks for sharing your story with us. Cody, is Samantha's story, is that pretty common? Do we know what the average amount of debt owed is?
Yeah, Samantha's story is very common. It's a story that you hear from supporters often, and it's really a story that I share in my repayment experience. You know, the average student debt for the class of 2018 was about $35,000. Imagine being in your 20s without a job necessarily and just leaving the school. That first monthly payment bill can be quite a shock.
And so the average debt we're looking at, is it about, so I'm sorry, it's about 80,000. Is that correct?
Well, you know, in our study of 7,000 student loan borrowers, we pegged the average student debt total at about $80,000. Now, when folks graduate, the number's closer to $35,000. But as Samantha touched on, we were talking to borrowers who are 10, 15, 20 years into repayment because of the difficulty they have bringing down their debt. And so in our research, we found that the average debt was around $80,000, which is an enormous burden. Now, granted, a lot of the folks who took our survey were graduate students with higher educations.
So bigger bills, right. And so when we're thinking about bills. So if we're thinking about the average debt, Cody, being around 80,000, mm-hmm. do you have a sense of what the average income for those folks were?
Yeah, those folks were actually making $60,000 a year on average individually. So their student debt is larger than their yearly income. And that can just feel so out of reach for so many of the folks we talked to.
Yeah, wow. So that's, I imagine then what leads you to the statistic that I mentioned in the beginning of your study, that 65% of the student loan borrowers you surveyed reported having less than $1,000 in their bank account?
Yes, that is correct. And, you know, that is a financial, I think, barometer that runs across the board. And it's worth noting that these are folks that are either young, and because they have very little in their bank accounts, they can't get married, they can't have kids, they can't start a family. It's also older borrowers that we speak to. And because of this, because of their financial thin ice, they can't save for retirement. And for others, it's just created an unbelievable stress burden. One important takeaway from our research was that 86% of people we spoke to with student debt said that it was a major source of stress in their life. Some of them even contemplated selling everything and living in their car just to be able to pay back their student loans.
That's terrible. Samantha, I imagine that if I were to ask you what the big stressors in your life are, being a mom of a three-year-old and married, would you say that your student loan debt and paying off your finances are probably your family's biggest stressor at this point?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think on a day-to-day, it's kind of, you know, easier to not think about it, but to maybe, like, you know, focus on the smaller things. But when you're definitely looking at, like, big picture goals and ideals for your family's future and saving and planning and things like that, it's definitely a weight on our shoulders that I don't think necessarily, you know, should have to be there if things were done right.
Cody, when we're thinking about new graduates, folks who graduated this year, they have a 6-month grace period after graduation. So for this year's grads, that period's ending soon. Samantha, it sounds like you did a lot of work. It sounds like you went through a lot of work figuring out what you needed to do with your finances, refinancing that. Cody, what should people be doing right now for the new graduates who are graduating this year?
Yeah, well, you know what? You just nailed it, Nyla. It does take a good amount of work. And that's part of the unfair part of our entire system. When you get your first monthly student loan payment or your bill from your student loan servicer, this is often the first time that folks have even heard of their student loan company. And many of them have not heard of any of their repayment options. So they're often shocked, scared, all of the above. And so we first encourage borrowers to reach out to their federal student loan servicing company. They are paid for by the federal government to help us understand our loans. And so it's always worth starting there. Unfortunately, because of a lot of the reporting and consumer complaints, it's pretty clear at this point that the servicing companies don't necessarily do their job. So there is a lot of onus on borrowers to go online to understand their options and really to empower themselves with their own knowledge. And we encourage borrowers to go directly to the source, which is the Department of Education's website. You can start at studentloans.gov. And the reason I say that is because folks who are facing their first repayment or scared because they can't afford their 100th repayment, they are often vulnerable to what we call debt relief scams. And these are folks that charge hundreds of dollars to essentially enroll people into free federal programs that you can apply for online in 10 to 15 minutes. And so it really starts with knowing your options, understanding your own personal student loan situation so that you can make the right choices and avoid being taken advantage of.
Samantha, how much education did you do? It sounds like you spent a lot of time also educating yourself on how to deal with this. How would you recommend people do that?
I think, you know, what Cody's saying is really accurate. You can't, you know, always take what your servicer says, you know, as complete truth. You know, there are some that are out there to help you, but for the most part, not necessarily. So I think, you know, getting online, making sure that, you know, you're on the right website, the studentloans.gov, and just really empowering yourself with information, you know, staying on top of things. It can just take a little bit of you know, self-control and responsibility in terms of just submitting paperwork on time and, you know, filing things appropriately. It's not that much work. You know, like Cody said, it could be done in, you know, 15 minutes or so in terms of filling out the paperwork for these programs. So I think it's just a matter of just jumping on the computer, you know, empowering yourself with the information and staying on top of it.
How do you not be overwhelmed by things, Samantha?
You know, just take things day by day. You know, I think, you know, with the way things have been streamlined, you know, online now, I can't even imagine how things were done, you know, snail mail wise, like filling out a form, sending it 6 weeks later, you haven't heard anything. Like, at least, you know, now I can jump on, I can see within a matter of days most of the time whether or not my paperwork has been submitted or is, you know, accepted or denied. So I think it is a little bit easier now. We have access to information quicker. But obviously, as a mom of a toddler and everything like that, day by day is always a good thing.
I want to thank Samantha Morgan for joining us, as well as Cody Hunanian with studentdebtcrisis.org. We'll tweet out that report. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much, Nyla.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, we talked retail for Black Friday and Cyber Monday, which is today. Tomorrow is Giving Tuesday, where many people take time to donate to their favorite charities and nonprofits. In 2017, the total amount of money that Americans donated went up by more than 5%. And here in Illinois, residents gave nearly $13.5 million to Illinois nonprofits on Giving Tuesday through the IL Give campaign. Susie Lee is the director of nonprofit strategy and engagement at Forefront, the Association of Philanthropies, Nonprofits, and Grantmakers that's behind the IL Give campaign. That's the hashtag, by the way, IL Give. Daniel Borkoff is the president of the independent watchdog organization Charity Watch. Both are on the line from Chicago. Hi, Susie. Daniel, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks so much for being with me.
Yes, hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you.
Susie, last year with IL Give, you raised, as I mentioned, almost $13.5 million. What's your goal this year?
This year, we'd love to hit that $15 million mark.
And what charities take part in IL Give, Susie?
So we are at exactly 725 nonprofits signed up on IL Give this year. And we've got folks, of course, tons in Chicago, but also we're really excited that we've got Joliet, Champaign, Rock Island. So you can find, you know, those familiar names like the YWCA and CASA. And then you can also find really small ones, neighborhood organizations like Barrel of Monkeys. They're an acting troupe. So it's a wide variety.
And what came up, so you guys came up with this hashtag in 2015, people can go to this website. How much of this do you think is because there is a focus on Giving Tuesday now, but maybe there's people get a little inundated on tomorrow, people may be inundated with different charities or emails on places of where to give. Is that why you guys started this?
Yeah, I mean, Giving Tuesday itself is intentionally a decentralized movement. So it's not owned by, you know, the 92nd Street Y in New York. They wanted to make sure that it was co-created. And we think that's why people really love it and it grows so much every year, because it's a huge movement, it's international, but it's also really local and it fits local communities.
So, Daniel, I wonder if people find on Giving Tuesday, I wonder with your work with Charity Watch, how you recommend people go about, if they're thinking about especially new charities, how they should go about doing research on that.
Oh, certainly anytime you get a brand new group that you're not familiar with, you want to do some research, you want to check it out. At Charity Watch, we have our top-rated charities with ratings A+ to F, just like in school, looking at factors that have to do with the financial efficiency and their whether they're being accountable and disclosing key information, such as like are there potential conflicts of interest under the surface that you would want to know about. So if you've already researched them and they're asking you to give more, certainly, and it's also a good opportunity to connect with new groups that you might want to look more into. Because people are thinking about, you know, the holiday giving season and the giving sentiment, but certainly, you know, check it out. You don't want to throw your money away, and be careful with lookalike charities. A lot of groups have very similar names.
Okay, we're going to get to some of those tips in a minute. Susie, can I ask you, when we're thinking about when it comes to, so a lot of people, obviously, Giving Tuesday is a good time of year because it's the end of the year. People are thinking about making those tax contributions that will count for this tax year. When we're thinking about how much, where people are giving their money, what kinds of money are people in Illinois giving donations to? What kinds of charities?
We see a lot around social justice work. Animal welfare is really popular, but we have folks that are also doing the arts on our website. Pretty much anything, environment, anything you can think of is there.
And Daniel was talking about doing your research, Susie. How would you recommend people, how are you guys vetting the charities that sign up for, it's IL Give or I'll Give, right? We can use either one. It's hashtag IL Give, though. We'll remember it that way.
That's right. So I'll Give, we have all of our nonprofits are verified 501c3s, and they have to be in good standing with the Illinois Attorney General's office in order to participate on our website. So absolutely. You know, we know that about 2/3 of people who make donations actually don't do research before they give. And sometimes that's okay. They're getting a recommendation from a friend. But if you're a first-time donor and you do want to do some research, ILGive.com has a great search option. So you can search by city, but you can also search by cause and connect to whatever you're passionate about.
And when we're thinking about this time of year, Susie, I'm just thinking about lots of people probably, if you think you were talking about social justice issues, I bet a lot of people gave money to political campaigns this year. I'm thinking about the natural disasters, in particular the terrible wildfires in California. Do you think that people feel like at this time of year, what does the research show? Or do you think people think, oh, I've already given enough this year? Or what does the research show on that front?
You know, I actually think this is one of the most inspiring things that I see in the research about giving is that there have been a number of studies that look at the last several years when there have been significant natural disasters, trying to see what impact they had on the regular end-of-year giving. And none of those studies have shown a significant decrease in annual giving after a natural disaster. And I think that just goes back to, you know, what you were saying about it's the time of year and the generosity that people are feeling. People tend to give and give again when they see a need and they feel inspired by it.
Susie was talking about the research that has to be done. She was saying something that I wanted to ask you about. She said 2/3 of people who give sometimes haven't done research on the organization. What do you all do at Charity Watch?
Well, we certainly encourage people to be more informed and more knowing, because people can exponentially increase the good of their giving with even just a little research. What we're concerned about particularly is how the money is being spent. There's a lot of financial manipulation, you know, of course, in the business world, but also in the nonprofit world, even sometimes within the rules that they're allowed to report, such as that solicitation that you get. Maybe they're saying that that's education, but maybe you don't want to fund education included in solicitations. You've got to find out what actually they're doing with the money. Like, look at what they're accomplishing. You know, how many people are they feeding? How many people are they vaccinating? You know, who are they helping? So you really want to look for specifics, because any group, no matter how bad they are, can point to, you know, a few good deeds and say, look, they did this. Aren't we great? And it may mean they're not really doing that, you know, that much overall. Be particularly careful with groups that get a lot of in-kind goods, because those values, particularly with pharmaceuticals, can be inflated and the groups are doing it. So find out with the cash, with the dollars they're receiving, what do they do? And Charity Watch goes through the analysis, audits, tax forms, websites. We look through a lot of material, line by line, note by note, kind of painstaking detail to give the donor a sense as to how the money is actually being spent.
And in kind, you mean, are you thinking about, for example, like a health organization that would have drugs donated and they count that as a financial contribution? Is that what you mean?
Well, they count that as a contribution. It shows up in the finances. And it may be that they're acquiring for pennies, like antibiotics or vitamins or deworming pills. And then they're saying they're worth dollars. They're worth like dollars. So and then they're actually buying them, and they're saying the reduced value that they're receiving is somehow a donation. So you got to be careful with that, because that can really throw off your understanding as to what's happening with your donated dollar. So we sort that out at Charity Watch. And, you know, we encourage you, too, when you give to a group that's primarily in kind, to find out what's happening with their dollars that they receive.
I'm speaking with Daniel Borikoff. He's Charity Watch's president and founder. Susie Lee's also on the line with us from Chicago, where she's with Forefront. She's been talking about I'll Give. Daniel, when we're thinking about giving to organizations, assuming they're reputable, what should we be checking in terms of how these organizations are using our information from a privacy standpoint?
Well, you want to see if they have a privacy policy, and be careful to read it, because it may be the case that their privacy policy is that they don't have a privacy policy if you actually read it.
That's hard, though, right, Daniel? Because I feel like it's like the terms of service. It's this really long thing. Do you feel like people should spend the time to read through that, though?
Well, it's not as bad with charities. I mean, if you want to maintain control over your nonprofits, over your identified information, but do be aware that that is an important source of revenue for charities. Like, if they want to sell it with other, sell, trade, exchange with other nonprofits that do similar work, hopefully they'll choose groups that, you know, are not scams, that are reasonable. They just don't put the list out there for anybody, you know, for any group to buy it. But you don't want to cut that off, because if you really believe in a cause, you may want to let them exchange it with some other groups, because the reality is people don't give to the same group every year. They like to switch around, and so groups have to continually get more money. But ideally, what you should have control, and they should seek your permission before they, you know, trade and sell your information. But you may want to give it to them if you really like the group and want to. You could look at it as another donation, because, you know, things like Facebook and Google, that's how they make their money, by having your information. So charities can also make money from having your information. Just make sure it's a group that you would trust and respect with your information.
Right. Susie, when we're thinking about something Daniel said, I was curious to ask you about, which is people, he said sometimes people switch around, they give different money to different places. Do you recommend that people create annual relationships with different organizations, or how do you recommend people go about doing that?
I think the most satisfying thing for both the donor and for the nonprofit is to have a long-term relationship. You know, you get to see how the organization grows, who they're reaching, who they're supporting. But at the same time, we know that I'll Give actually is really strong with engaging first-time donors. Last year, over 25% of all the donors on I'll Give were donating for the first time. So again, that kind of goes back to folks really looking for an opportunity to connect with someone they haven't given to before.
And Susie, when we're thinking about that as well, and thinking about connecting with organizations, I think when we're thinking about in terms of what people give, there's lots of times this time of year, there's also clothing and canned food drives during the holidays. What do you think about donating those sorts of things versus money?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anytime folks are giving back to the community and they're supporting nonprofits, that is great. We're happy about that. The more our communities come together, the stronger we all are. If folks are able dollars are likely to be the most impactful gift you can give to a nonprofit. That's one of the reasons we really focus on those financial gifts. So, you know, it can be great to give away the winter coat and jars of peanut butter and all of those things. You know, especially for kids, it's great to give away a tangible thing. But when we think about nonprofits, you know, it's really hard to cover those general operating costs that are kind of not so flashy and exciting. We often call those real costs. You know, the things they need, like paying the rent and keeping the lights on and providing good benefits to their employees. Those are all really important to be a strong organization.
And Susie, when we're thinking about that in particular, also I'm thinking about the budget crisis, and we're thinking about Illinois nonprofits, particularly social service agencies. Keeping the lights on 2 years ago was a very real problem for a lot of places throughout the state. I wonder how you think nonprofits, particularly in Illinois, have communicated that to people. Is it different now with social media? Is giving a little bit different? Do you think companies are more transparent, nonprofits are more transparent about those needs?
I think we're getting there. I think definitely the budget crisis sort of forced folks to talk about what those operating costs, those real costs of operating, look like. But, you know, there are still a lot of nonprofits that are struggling, even since the budget crisis, to make ends meet. So I think it's still a story that we're working on telling.
Danielle, how would you like nonprofits to ask for money? What's the best way?
Well, I want to point out something earlier just so people understand how the accounting and financial reporting is done, that most salaries are program expenditures. Most of the rent and light costs are program expenditures. They are not overhead. It depends on what the person is doing. If the person is, you know, serving the people, if the person is a nurse taking care of patients, if the person is supervising nurses, doesn't touch a patient, that's still program administration. So people do need to understand that, you know, these things are, she uses the word real, but they are actually, a lot of these expenses are real program expenses. So I just want to point that out. As far as your second question is, groups should be open and honest exactly what their needs are, and then not try to just raise money for what people are most likely, you know, wanting to give for, but what they're actually going to do with the money. And they need to be, as transparent and clear, and then not raise more money than they need raised, you know, have the budget and then raise money for that budget. And then once they've exceeded that, then let people know that the money, you know, is now for something else.
Daniel, I wonder if you think, are there this time of year in the holiday season when it's Giving Tuesday, do you think there are any pitfalls that donors fall into? Do you think maybe people are in a rush to cross donations off their list before the end of the year, or other things people should be wary of?
Yeah, because it's such a heavy shopping time. You know, people, if they're looking for the tax benefits, they have until the end of the year, but it's a good time to prompt them and get them thinking about it and encourage it, you know, encouraging them to do it. Some of these matching grants you have to be careful with. It's certainly attractive and desirable. That's become almost a standard practice for the groups to say, you know, you give us, you know, $100, we'll match that $100. But be aware that that may not be brand new money coming because of your donation. It may be money that they've already received and just be an internal transfer. So just, you know, word to the wise about, you know, about the matching grants. Sometimes it's brand new money. Sometimes it's just internal money being transferred, money that they would have had anyway.
I wanted to end by asking both of you, Daniel, let's start with you. Earlier in the show, we were actually talking about student debt and how it hurts people financially when it comes to their saving. And I imagine there are a lot of people out there who would love to give but are juggling all of their expenses, especially this time of year. Susie, how do you think about the many families who are on the fence about whether to give? What would you say?
I'd say for folks that are worried about a financial gift, there are so many ways they can give back. You know, donating time and spending time with an organization and participating in their services is huge. Donating blood, just acts of kindness are something that go a really long way. So any way that folks can give, we support it.
Daniel, I'll let you have the last word here.
Oh, well, I would encourage people to get the conversation out there. It's really easy on social media, so maybe they, you know, maybe their parents, you know, have more money or some friends with the tech industry or something and are doing really well, and they could, you know, share some of these causes and great groups with them, and then they could be, you know, prepare for the future, you know, to give. And once they get the conversation going, they're more likely to give when they do have the funds.
Oh, that's right. So give when you give, tell everybody that you're giving and why.
No, tell people the potential opportunities that they may want to, if you really care dearly about a cause, you can let other people know about that cause, and then they can, you know, motivate them as well if you don't have the resources yourself.
A couple of resources we mentioned, Charity Watch, I'll Give or IL Give. We will tweet that out and have that at 21stshow.org. I want to thank Daniel Borokoff and Susie Lee with Forefront. Guys, thanks for being with me. I hope everything goes well for you guys tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This year in politics, the word November has been synonymous with Election Day, but it's also a time for state lawmakers to vote on one last set of bills before the holidays. And this is called the veto session. From Tuesday to Thursday of this week, the General Assembly will continue to take up bills that Governor Rauner has vetoed. In this case, it could be as many as dozens of them. And if you need to brush up on your Illinois civics, it takes 3/5 of the vote in the State House and State Senate to override a governor's veto and turn a bill into law. Amanda Vinicky is a correspondent with WTTW Chicago's Tonight. She's on the line with us now. Hi, Amanda. Welcome back to the 21st. Good morning. Hey, Amanda. It sounds like we've got a tough connection there. Can you hear me okay?
It's better. I hear you just fine.
Yes, now I can hear you. Great.
Any better?
Yes, thank you.
Amanda,
what's the mood like in the state capitol this time of year? We've had lawmakers who had a busy election season. They were back for a couple of days for the first part of this veto session, off for Thanksgiving. Folks are gathering in Springfield today.
They'll be starting to get in town today up in area. There was a whole lot of snow, so perhaps some people are waiting it out and they'll arrive by tomorrow morning. But I think the mood being probably stuffed on turkey leftovers, still, if they're anything like me, is one of anticipation. This veto session, it is certainly significant, of course, because anytime you have a prospect of a new law that will affect people's lives, sure. But really, I think people are waiting for the new year, for the new administration. Sometimes during veto session, you may recall back, you know, in 2011, the quote lame duck tax increase that increased Illinois' income tax rate. We don't expect to see anything like that because really Democrats will have all the control to do anything and everything that they want starting in January. And so there's some chatter, maybe talk of a capital bill percolating, but again, that would probably not be until January or anything. This veto session, they certainly have lots of bills to work with, but the true attention is still focused on January.
And I do want to get to January and what's next for that in a minute, but first let's just focus on what's happened right already.
Yeah.
There's already been one veto that was overridden in the state Senate. And that was part of the Voices Act. We heard a lot about this during the campaign, Amanda, but this is actually specifically for victims of sexual abuse or human trafficking. What veto was overridden here?
So that was in the Senate, and it still does need to go before the House, although I think the anticipation is that it should have no problem there, and legislators will likely override the governor's objections, putting the Voices Act into law. And as you noted, this is for victims of human trafficking, kidnapping, what have you, sexual assault. And should they work with law enforcement to catch the perpetrators of these crimes, these individuals, these immigrants would be eligible for a certain type of visa. What this measure does is say that law enforcement has to fill out certification, basically the paperwork saying, yes, this person did work with us, help us to catch this, the culprit of the crime. Or they could even in that paperwork say, you know, they didn't actually do very much. Whatever it is, they have to have that paperwork filled out in 2 months' time, basically, so that then these individuals could get processed. And the plan would be to likely receive those visas. And that came about as an issue because rumor has it, or at least you had local state's attorneys in certain cases not sending forward that paperwork. So immigrants that, you know, had done their part and worked with law enforcement then never actually got the visas that they were eligible for because police or state's attorneys, again, didn't submit that paperwork. So advocates say that it is fair and just, but Rauner in his veto objected to it, saying that that's just too much paperwork for police who already have a lot to deal with and could give room for error. Those were among some of his objections in his mandatory or in his veto.
So just to be clear, Amanda, this is for people, immigrants who are here illegally, but are victims of sexual abuse or human trafficking. Mm-hmm. And it's only for victims of sexual abuse, human trafficking. Is it also, I think, domestic violence? And then if in those cases they qualify for the special kind of visas, that's the one that we're now waiting to see if the House overrides Governor Rauner's veto of this part of the act, correct?
Yeah, really, this is, that's where we're looking at. But again, this isn't, you know, creating these visas or anything. That's done on the federal level. All this particular measure would do is require police within 60 days to fill out paperwork at the completion of their work with these immigrants who had worked with them on the cases in situations like you talked about, in sexual assault, for example, or human trafficking.
Right, because this hasn't it always, this is,
that
yeah,
any,
mm-hmm. hasn't this, and I'm just curious, this has sort of been standard practice for a while, right?
This has been standard practice. I'm not an expert on these visas and on immigration in general. But yeah, this isn't creating anything new there. Really, like I said, it comes about because apparently what we have heard is that there were cases where paperwork wasn't going through to the federal government, thereby immigrants weren't receiving these visas. And this is trying to take that out of the way and giving police a deadline. People saying, you know, sometimes folks, we're journalists, Nyla, so yeah, deadlines
make people do things, right?
By a certain time, sometimes it makes a difference. So that's giving, that's all that this measure does. And that's where you do see that advocates for the immigration community really saw this as Rauner's veto as an election move. That came about, of course, before his loss to Pritzker. And so it was seen as his trying to curry favor with conservatives, particularly given that it was such a different position from how he had previously both in action in terms of on previous bills, but also particularly as a candidate the first time around when he was really seen as being on the side of immigrants. So, We will see, but like I said, it's widely expected that that one will become law, regardless of Rauner's thoughts.
And another one has to do with the smoking age. There's a bill that would raise a legal smoking age from 18 to 21. Am I right about that?
So, yeah. And interestingly, it doesn't technically raise the smoking age. It is the age at which a vendor, a shopkeeper,
can sell,
cigarettes or, well, you know, I mean, I think it's widely been phrased as raising the smoking age because in effect, that's what it does. But, you know, just kind of to be clear on what the actual legislation does, that's what it would do. And the thought, of course, is that this would help to prevent youth from getting that addictive and hazardous to their health habit. It's not just cigarettes, by the way, obviously, it would be any sort of smoking project. Smoking, you know, accoutrement.
So this is like vaping, e-cigarettes, kind of the whole, all of that.
Cigarellos, vaping, exactly. The whole gamut.
And this is something Governor Rauner had vetoed. So we'll be watching to see what happens with that.
Yeah, Governor Rauner vetoed it. The Senate already overrode his veto. So this one now goes to the House, where, as you noted earlier, do need 3/5 of the members of the House of Representatives to do what the Senate had did in order for it to become law. That could be tough. You only had 61 representatives vote for the measure initially, and another 10 would need to change their position in order to make that law. So we'll see. That is one that is getting a lot of attention because I think, obviously, it is one that could affect a lot of people, but also because, you know, those 10 votes, will anybody change? Again, you have a lot of legislators that aren't going to be returning, either because they lost races or because they are retiring. They may well change their minds. But then again, they may not. This is one where they probably were lobbied pretty hard on both sides the first time around and may not be apt to change their morals or their stance regardless.
Amanda, when we're thinking about this time of year, and you've, as you mentioned, there are lawmakers who are leaving, everything sort of turns over in January. How much does the election affect all of this? The fact that there will be a new governor who will be inaugurated in January, a governor who will be a Democrat, when we're looking at the supermajority in the House for Speaker Madigan, we're looking at some pretty big numbers in both the House and the Senate, right?
Oh, yes. Nyla, I mean, I think the election really affects everything. In part, that's because you don't see Republicans voting in line with Governor Bruce Rauner's wishes as you'd had in the past. He really held that caucus, held all Republicans pretty tight there for a while. He had, you know, so much money and kind of whatever he said went. He no longer really is a player in that regard. He is already a lame duck. And frankly, we haven't seen him out publicly working any of these measures. So if
what have we heard from Governor Rauner?
If he were coming back, not much, really. He has been very, very, very low key since his election night loss and a really fairly early speech. He made some comments on Thanksgiving when both he and First Lady Diana Rauner went to a, you know, food pantry and gave meals to the, you know, to the less fortunate and those who didn't have their own turkeys at home that day. But at that point in time, he made the same sort of statements that he truthfully has been saying for years in terms of bettering Illinois, and it's not a partisan issue. It's about Republicans, Democrats, anybody working together. So the same old statements there. That's not to say that there aren't phone calls coming from the governor's office out to legislators trying to get them to stay on his side, but it certainly is a very different dynamic than we have seen in the past from Rauner himself and from his office. So that's where we might well see, as we did with, for example, the Voices Act, Republicans not feeling the need to protect him in upholding any vetoes and being fine and joining along Democrats in overriding Rauner.
So this is a bigger question, Amanda, but I wonder where we see the future of the Republican Party in Illinois going forward as folks are regrouping from what happened this year and what we might see ahead in January. I wonder what people are talking about now.
You know, Nyla, that is probably a whole show could be devoted to that one. I think it really depends on who you talk to. Every time that I have seen Republicans get together on various, you know, panels or even just casually in trying to figure out an answer to that question, there's still very much a divide. This is still raw. So I don't think that necessarily bodes well for regrouping or presenting a united front when you don't have Republicans agreeing even on not only on how to fix it, but whether there needs to be a fix. I would say the answer to that is clearly that there needs to be, just given the losses that the GOP saw and if they want to maintain any power. But you certainly have factions of the party that say they believe that their conservative principles are the ones that will carry the way. And then other factions of the party that point back to the days of Edgar and Thompson and say that the only way that Republicans can be successful statewide, meaning both statewide constitutional offices, but also in general, in terms of gaining more seats in the General Assembly, would be to take a more moderate sort of position and stance on issues. So that continues to be very much a divide, and it's not clear who the leaders of that effort will be. You did see Tim Schneider, the current head of the Republican Party and an ally of Rauner, will again no longer have Rauner there. It's not clear whether Rauner will be contributing any more to the party in terms of funds, as they've heavily relied on him. You saw him already take steps back this current election cycle versus 2 years and, of course, 4 years back. And then certainly Dick Uihlein continues to be a major funder and a player in Republican politics, giving a whole ton of money to Dan Proft. And so you have a whole lot of players that are not necessarily in elected positions or technical heads of the Republican Party, but are definitely figureheads and power players.
Yeah, lots there. We're thinking as we think about January as well, we'll have the most in Illinois' 200-year history in terms of women in the Senate, 20. So it'll be interesting. We'll talk about that with you at a later date. I want to thank Amanda Vinicky with WTTW Chicago tonight.
Lady power.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you, Nyla.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll be talking about poverty in the Chicago suburbs. WBEZ Chicago and the Better Government Association have been looking into this. We'll hear why poverty in the suburbs is higher than in the city, what it looks like across Illinois. Plus, we'll also be talking about Starved Rock State Park getting a lot bigger. The state has bought more. Oh, and Matheson State Park, more than 2,600 acres of land. The state park superintendent joins us. That's tomorrow's program on the 21st. If you tune in for that. If you go to 21stshow.org, we've got all our information on this shows and past shows, as well as ways to contact us. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I'll see you back here tomorrow.